Humble the jungle, John, and carry it to a secluded spot in the backyard, where my neighbors won't accidentally see me. After finally emptying my bladder, I notice that the jungle John has no lid. To keep the smell from attracting animals, I tie the ends of the bag together. I don't want to waste these bags. I'm going to need them. As I walk back indoors, I'm reminded, for some reason, of when I was 10 years old at overnight camp. Every Wednesday, the counselors took us to town so we could purchase a couple dollars worth of candy. Most campers ate all their candy within the hour, but I hid the candy in my duffel bag to save for when I needed it most. Each week I stockpiled more sweets until, at the end of the year, I had to throw most of my candy out. But I had no regrets over the waste. Though I never got to eat it all, I always had candy when I wanted it. Even at age 10, I was already stockpiling supplies. I write on my troubleshooting list, more biodegradable toilet bags. 10:30 a.m. I learned in cert class that in an emergency, I should first eat everything in my refrigerator that could go bad. Then I should move on to the freezer, and only then should I dip into the canned foods, MREs, and emergency supplies. I check the refrigerator. There's milk, eggs, cheese, more butter than I can possibly consume in a day, tortellini, half a pizza, and leftover Chinese food. I gather twigs and sticks from the side of the road, add a strand of jute rope to use as tinder, and build a fire outside so I can make an omelet. Then I check the refrigerator to figure out what to add to it. The carton of Chinese leftovers seems to be in immediate danger of putrefaction. I look at the egg rolls inside. They're vegetables, meat, and eggs, basically. So I bring them to the fire, peel away the fried wrapper, and dump the contents into my omelet, avoiding the cabbage whenever I can. The result? One of the most delicious omelets of my life. Necessity is truly the mother of invention. I write on my troubleshooting list, more egg rolls. 11:30 a.m. My next challenge is one thing the survivalists never taught me. How to wash the dishes when the shit hits the fan. Without a creek, lake, or pond nearby, I'm not about to waste my precious drinking water to scrub a frying pan. As I stack the dishes in the kitchen sink, I realize there's water everywhere around me. Half the houses in the area have swimming pools, and most of my neighbors are probably at work. Though my house has a small pool of sorts, I drained it months ago because it was old and the plaster was cracking. So I grab a waterproof plastic storage container from my garage, sneak into a neighbor's backyard, fill the box halfway with chlorinated water, and run home, sloshing liquid everywhere. I'm only half a day into my survival test, and already I'm looting the neighbors. Maybe the gun nuts were right, after all. I write on my troubleshooting list, repair and fill pool. 1:30 p.m. After eating, I return to the computer and enjoy an hour of uninterrupted writing time, until suddenly I feel a kick in my stomach. Now a gurgle, then a push. I try to ignore it. The last thing I want to do is sit on a piece of cardboard in my yard and take a dump in the blazing sun. I need to control myself. I can't go through this after every meal. I must hoard my shits like candy at camp and save them for when I want them. Survival is easy until your body begins to make demands. I cross out more egg rolls on my troubleshooting list. 2 p.m. I walk outside to urinate, but I'm horrified to see a small puddle leaking from underneath the jungle john. I lift the bag to check for a hole, and there's water dripping from the plastic in multiple spots. Evidently, the bag is already biodegrading. I take it outside and carefully throw it in a trash can. Then I grab a regular garbage bag and use it to line the jungle john. I never imagined so much of this journal would be devoted to my waste functions. I'll never take a flushing toilet for granted again. I cross out more biodegradable toilet bags on my troubleshooting list. 4 p.m. I eat the leftover pizza, then start the generator so I can charge my computer. As I'm writing, Katie drops by with her sister. Katie is wearing a tight pink t-shirt, a pair of low-rise jeans, and 3-inch heels. She is the very apex of civilization. The air conditioner isn't working, she complains. That's because I'm doing the 3-day test now. It's too hot, baby. I'm going to Kendra's house. It's cooling off. I just opened all the doors. I don't want her to leave. I don't want to be alone. Stay with me tonight. It'll be, fun. Can I still use my curling iron? I can put the generator near the bathroom, and we can use extension cords. What about going to the bathroom? I have a little toilet I set up outside. Want to see it? Does it flush? No, it's just a little bag. I'm going to Kendra's. I write on my troubleshooting list, get a more adventurous girlfriend. Day 2. 2:30 p.m. I've been so busy today, I haven't been able to write until now. Living without conveniences takes time. I had to clean out the refrigerator and eat just about everything that could possibly rot. Then I gathered wood, built a fire, made soup, cooked fried chicken strips from the freezer, borrowed more washing water from the neighbors, cleaned the dishes in the grill, and added gas to the generator. It would be a lot of work doing this for a 4-person family. It seems that almost everything we call modern, everything we think separates us from previous generations, serves only a small number of purposes. To help us avoid pain, minimize work, and/or save time. Otherwise, we're not that much different from our primitive ancestors. As soon as I finish lunch, my stomach cramps. There's no denying my body this time. Maybe the chicken was bad. I can barely untie the knot on the garbage bag fast enough. The cardboard throne is surprisingly stable under my weight. And there's actually something pleasant about taking a dump while sitting in the sun. It's like being in a nudist beach. I can even get a tan at the same time. If you ever see me with golden brown skin, but white marks in the shape of elbows on my knees, you'll know what I've been doing. I write on my troubleshooting list, get Imodium, just in case. 7 p.m. When night falls, I shut the doors to trap the heat in, bring all the tools inside, replace the batteries in my lights and flashlights, fill the lanterns with kerosene, and build a fire for dinner. I take the last of my mostly defrosted fish out of the freezer, gut them, and stuff them with spices, lemon, and onion. Then I wrap them in tinfoil and place them on the coals of the fire. While waiting for them to cook, I realize I need to shave. I bring a handheld mirror out to my dishwasher container, set it up on the drying table, and start shaving. When I finish, Katie comes by. Hopefully she won't ask why my face smells like dish soap and chicken grease. She's with her friends Kendra and Brittany. She never arrives alone, because she's still too scared to drive. Romantic, Kendra says when she sees the house. Katie smiles. I can see this makes her more comfortable staying here. Maybe instead of calling everything primitive, I can just call it romantic and get her more involved. Camping can be a romantic trip for two under the stars. Shooting guns can be a romantic fireworks display. Skinning an animal can be a romantic trip to the mall for a new coat. I know you don't like being here with the power out, I say, but I'm making a romantic dinner right now, and I'd love it if you could join me. What are you making? I'm preparing some fish I caught. With your bare hands? With a fishing pole. What about the bathroom? If the bathroom toilet has one good flush left, it's all yours. I lead Katie and her friends outside to show them the fire pit. The fish seem finished, so I remove them from the coals and unwrap them. The skin peels off perfectly, and the bone slips right out, leaving tender white meat that drops off in perfect flakes. Her friends stay to eat with us, and we feast on every bite in the glow of the lanterns. This is like the perfect Friday night, Kendra tells Katie. You're so lucky. I have to stop dating these club losers and find a real man. Try checking the Santa Monica Pier for fishermen, Katie replies. Despite the joke, she's beaming ear to ear. She picks up a lantern and walks proudly to the bathroom. I hope it flushes. I cross, no fish, off my troubleshooting list. Day 3, 10 a.m. My refrigerator and freezer are nearly empty of solid food. No more eggs, no more meat except 2 soggy chicken breasts I'm saving for dinner. Not even an unmelted pat of butter. Though Katie wants cereal, the milk has gone bad. so I start a fire, heat up water, and make oatmeal instead. If we had a goat, we'd have milk for the cereal, Katie says, her head nestled on my chest as we curl up on the couch after breakfast. It could be like our dog, but better than a dog, because it doesn't go around biting things. It just chews on shoelaces. Since that fateful afternoon with Mad Dog, Katie hasn't stopped talking about Betty. I suppose seeing her as a rug every time she enters the living room doesn't help much. I know, I told her. I looked into it after going to that permaculture place, but I don't know where to keep it. Maybe you could just keep it in the pool. Raising livestock is the first survival skill Katie has been supportive of, and I'd actually found a person willing to sell me a beautiful alpine goat. So maybe keeping it in the pool wasn't such a bad idea. After all, a live dairy goat, perhaps paired with a male for mating, would be better than a whole larder of canned food when the shit hits the fan. And maybe it would help ease my conscience and fulfill the nurturing obligations of the circle of life that Mad Dog had mentioned. I cross repair and fill pool off my troubleshooting list. My neighbors are going to kill me. 1 p.m. With Katie acting as a lookout, I take a covert plunge in the neighbor's pool in lieu of a shower, then dip into the rations for lunch. Peanut butter, Nutella, and graham crackers. Afterward, Katie and I make love on the couch. It's the sixth time we've done it since last night. I could get used to this. 5 p.m. Katie wants to make s'mores. I like that she's getting into the spirit of this. We walk along the road together and gather twigs and dead leaves. I teach her how to build a fire, and we roast marshmallows on sticks together. Since the fire's already going, I decide to make the last of my perishable food. I teach Katie, who's never cooked anything in her life but Pop-Tarts, how to prepare and season the chicken breasts. Despite her fears of fire, raw chicken, and work, she tosses the meat on the grill and cooks it. "It's all wet and gushy and gross," she says. "Am I going to get a disease from this?" she asks. "I don't want to burn myself," she complains. But she sees the project through, and when she's done, the chicken is soft and moist, with spices cooked deep into the meat. It pulls off the bone in scalloped shreds. It may be the best chicken we've ever had. Though I can't wait to turn the power back on, I'm enjoying this. I was never able to understand how people could live happily in the past without electricity and modern conveniences. Now I understand. They got along just fine. I cross, get a more adventurous girlfriend, off my troubleshooting list. 7 p.m. I think of all the half-empty soda cans I've thrown in the trash, all the half-finished plates of food I've scraped into the disposal, and all the times I've said, "No thanks," when a waitress asked if I wanted a doggy bag. Now that my refrigerator and freezer are devoid of anything edible, and every sip of water and morsel of food has become precious, I'm ashamed of my wasteful past. I think of all the times I took long showers, left the lights on when I went out, ran water in the sink to cover up bathroom sounds, and maintained a house temperature of 73 degrees day and night. Thanks to this test, I've come to realize most of that consumption was completely unnecessary. But because all those resources are there, because they seem limitless, because they're available at the press of a button or the flick of a switch, I and most others use them far too much. Perhaps the root of the energy crisis is not our wasteful habits, but the ease with which seemingly unlimited power, gas, and water are available to us. In a normal 3 days, with Katie and her sister at the house most nights, I use 531 gallons of water. This week, I've used just a gallon. In a normal 3 days, I burn 121 kilowatt hours of electricity. This week, all my electricity has come from a gallon and a half of gasoline. In a normal 3 days, I use 2.28 therms of gas. This week, all my heat has come from dead leaves, sticks, and a ball of jute. 10 p.m. I search through my rations for a late-night snack. I'm starving. Most of what I find is crackers, trail mix, and some canned food. Nothing seems substantial enough. Then I notice my 9/11 safety bag in the living room and remember the MREs. Supposedly they last 7 years, and this just happens to be their seventh year. I open an MRE. There's a packet of grape drink mix with absolutely no nutritional value, which I dump into a bottle of water to create some sort of weak Kool-Aid. The next package reads, cracker, vegetable on it. There's also a tube of grape jelly in the envelope, which I assume goes on the cracker. Together they taste pretty good, and due to some feat of army engineering, don't produce any crumbs. I'm beginning to think I can live off these until I open the next package, which is marked chicken stew. I squeeze it into a bowl, and it sits there brown and chunky like dog food. But I trust the Army Corps of Food Engineers, so I take a bite. I don't know if it's spoiled, if it's supposed to taste this bad, or if I need to heat it up or something. As I'm trying to force it down, there's a knock on the door. It's Katie's sister, Grace, dropping by. As she sits down on the couch next to me, I notice she has a bag of takeout food in her hands. I watch as she removes an entire pineapple from the bag. She pulls off the top of the fruit, and the smell of delicious Thai cooking fills the room. "Do you want some?" she asks when she catches me staring at the steaming hot food she's spooning out of the hollowed-out pineapple. "I can't. That pineapple shouldn't even be here. You're ruining my disaster simulation. Just try some. We won't tell anyone." I'm trying to see what it's like to live in a world without takeout restaurants. "You're missing out." "No, you are," I say, and take a bite of my gruel, trying to repress the gag reflex that follows. I force the rest of the chicken stew down my throat, unwilling to let anything go to waste, then move on to dessert, which is a lemon pound cake that tastes surprisingly fresh after 7 years in storage. I write on my troubleshooting list, "Buy better MREs." 11 p.m. Day 3 is coming to a close. Tonight or tomorrow, Tomas will come by and end the simulation. I feel like I've been on vacation, and I'm not looking forward to the phone calls, emails, and obligations waiting for me when I return to the plugged-in world. Not only have I learned a lot from what was basically a simple test, but it's been one of the most romantic weekends Katie and I have ever had. We needed this. If there's ever a citywide shutdown, I won't look at it as an inconvenience anymore, but as an opportunity. Day 4, 9:30 a.m. "Baby," Katie is nudging me awake, "I want a shower." Tomas should have been here by now. I check the door to see if he's left a note. Nothing. I want to just turn the gas, water, and electricity on, but I must follow the rules. So I eat dry cereal, wash it down with warm water, turn on the generator, and write. When do I get to shower? When Tomas comes. I'm going to Kendra's. 12:30 p.m. I sit listlessly on the couch. I've gone through some beef jerky and tuna fish, and now I'm eating peanut butter and graham crackers again. I feel like life is passing me by. I could continue like this for weeks more, but I'm beginning to miss another thing the survivalists don't stockpile. Variety. There are no channels and nothing's on. There are no restaurants and no specials of the day. There are no websites and no new episodes of Homestar Runner. There's just me in my house with my stuff. 2:30 p.m. Still no sign of Tomas. I start writing a comprehensive list of supplies I'll need to survive for a month, so I can keep stashes both here and in St. Kitts. Of course, now that people know I'm stockpiling, the first thing all my friends will probably do when there's a disaster is run to my house. I suppose they'll make an excellent source of protein. Why do I keep making these jokes? Is there a half-truth somewhere in them? I used to fear being the eaten. Now I fear being the eater. 7 p.m. Still no sign of Tomas. I wish I could use my cell phone. I'm going to walk to his house if he doesn't come soon. That's fair. 10 p.m. This isn't fun anymore, or romantic. It's lonely and irritating. I have things to do, people to see, goats to order. Day 5, 9:15 a.m. A loud, urgent knocking on the door wakes me. I walk downstairs to find Tomas, looking repentant. "Did you turn everything back on already?" he asks. "No, I was following the rules." "I'm sorry. Well, is the emergency over? Yes, sorry, it completely slipped my mind. I hate him right now, but I'm also grateful for the lesson he accidentally taught me. It may be fun to have a vacation from modern conveniences, but it's hell to live there. I write on my troubleshooting list, Fire Tomas. Lesson 48. Exam number 2. Bug out. Land. When the shit hits the fan, some people won't have to worry about finding a bug out location. If they don't live in an isolated area already, they at least have a close relative living on a farm, raising a family in an outer suburb, or renting a summer retreat. But I come from a long line of committed urban dwellers. They live in the high rises of Chicago, the working class boroughs of Boston, the hillside homes of San Francisco. Basically, everywhere you don't want to be when the system collapses. Consequently, since restocking my supplies after my 3-day test, I was well prepared to bug in, but I still lacked a fail-safe plan to bug out. If you're going to live in the city, the key is getting out ahead of time, said Kevin Reeve from Urban Evasion class when I called him for advice. You need to keep your finger on the pulse and look for tripwires. If Israel attacked Iran, for example, I'd be on the next plane to St. Kitts. If you get stuck in L.A., your next best bet is to shelter in place. Bugging out would be your last resort. On his next trip to California, Reeve took a few days off work to help devise my escape. Evidently, he meant what he said over dinner in Oklahoma City when he told me he'd be my network. Reeve and I spent the morning studying topographical maps of California, assessing the survival potential of dozens of lakes and reservoirs. Our goal was to choose 3 different locations and escape routes, so that no matter what type of disaster struck, I'd have at least 1 getaway option. That afternoon, we tested our first bug-out plan and rode a motorcycle through the hills and fire roads to Malibu Lake, 30 miles away. En route, we checked for possible obstacles, traffic choke points, and roads wide enough so that I could weave to avoid shooters. This area actually has everything you need to survive, Reeve informed me when we arrived at the lake. There's water, fish, edible plants, animal tracks, and yucca for cordage. You could hide in the cottonwoods here for weeks. As we scouted the area, he plucked a yucca leaf and showed me how the pointy tip could be used as a needle to suture wounds. Then he picked up a stick and poked at a lump of nearby poo to see what type of animal had made it. It's composed of cereal, he informed me. Must be a dog. I added poo reading to my survival to-do list. Then I scratched it out. Some skills were better left to the experts. Air. In search of a second, more remote bug-out option, I called Mad Dog for advice. You need to get yourself an autogyro, he said firmly, as if it were as essential as a good knife. Then fly over all the shit, rather than navigate through it. If you get an autogyro with pontoons, you can land on a mountain lake that has no road access. You could live there forever with just a 7-pound tent, a little fuel, an axe, a saw, and a fishing pole. It sounded like the perfect way to isolate myself from the chaos and danger of a collapsing society, so I started looking into gyrocopters. The problem was that gyrocopter kits cost between $10,000 and $30,000, and my survival expenses had already put me in debt. In addition, I had nowhere to store it, so I'd have to rent extra space somewhere. I inspected helicopters as well, and though they also seemed ideal for bugging out, a decent used one cost well over $150,000. So I chose a more affordable option, United Airlines. Obviously, a commercial jet wouldn't be a feasible escape option when the shit hit the fan, but for now, it was the quickest way to find a second bug-out location, far from the smog of Los Angeles. To make sure I learned something from the experience, I gave myself a new 3-day test that probably would have killed me 6 months earlier. I decided to make sure I'd completely shed my addiction to the system and could survive 3 days in the wilderness with nothing but a knife and my wits to sustain me. In case I accidentally ate California parsley surprise and died, I brought Reeve along to keep an eye on me. As additional backup, after I arrived, I buried a cache of survival supplies. Though I'd spent months preparing, the test was nothing like what I envisioned. Nature has a way of defying even the best laid plans. It took half a day and both of my shoelaces to make a bow drill and start a fire. It took 3 days and a 3-mile hike before I found a single edible plant. I didn't even come close to hitting an animal with my throwing stick, and I couldn't set traps because they're illegal in national parks. I didn't have enough daylight to build a debris hut when I arrived, so I had to sleep against a tree and cover myself with a mound of leaves for warmth. It took hours to purify water, because open fires were prohibited, and I had to build a small, hidden scout fire. And when I finally caught an animal with my bare hands, a salamander with translucent skin, bulging eyes, and a long, slimy tail, I didn't have the stomach to eat it. But despite my discomfort and salamander squeamishness, I survived. I lived off the land for the first time in my life. It was one of the most liberating feelings I'd ever had. By the time I left, I knew I'd be able to stay out there as long as I needed. I wouldn't be comfortable, but I'd be alive. I couldn't believe how far I'd come since my snivelly nights at tracker school. C. Wind and salt spray whipped against my sun-beaten face as the sailboat picked up speed, dipping its rails into the deep blue of the Pacific and bringing me closer to the final location in my bug-out simulation. I couldn't imagine a more ideal and exhilarating way to escape the city when the shit hit the fan. There'd be no traffic jams, no roadblocks, no need for fuel, and no looters out here, unless a small pirate subculture suddenly developed. And fortunately, Ree was in the process of telling me how to deal with that very contingency. If you're attacked by pirates, you can sink their boat with your Remington shotgun. Just remove a slug from the shell casing and drill a quarter-inch hole in the slug. Then insert a .22 short round backward and replace the slug. When fired at the waterline of most boats, the round will blow a hole that can sink it. We were on our way to Catalina Island, 20 miles due south of Los Angeles. With a population of 4,000, the island would be relatively safe from rioting and violence. An inflatable dinghy, stocked with supplies and stored near the ocean, would at least be more affordable than anything in the copter family. With a fishing pole, I'd have easy access to food. With a desalinator, I'd have a lifetime supply of drinking water. And with a sail kit, I'd have an inexhaustible source of energy. You know this is pointless, right? Katie's voice interrupted my scheming. I brought her on my final test run, because if I ever bugged out, I'd be taking her with me, and I wanted her to be prepared. What do you mean? You're just going to Catalina to dig holes in the ground for no reason. Do you mean the cash? She shrugged. I'd brought along an army ammunition can, loaded with freeze-dried food, water, and other survival essentials. The point is to bury supplies. This way, as long as I can sail to Catalina, I can always survive there. She dropped her head into my lap, stretched her legs along the sailboat bench, and fell fast asleep. She was tired from the Dramamine she'd taken for seasickness, and in a generally cranky mood. Not only was she worried the boat would hit a rock and sink, but she hadn't eaten dinner the night before or breakfast that morning. She reminded me of the boy in Cormac McCarthy's The Road, whose innocence and compassion constantly interfere with his father's attempts to keep him alive. I wondered whether the compassionate would be the first to go when the shit hit the fan, or if they would outlast the remorseless, which I was fast becoming. Reeve reached into a paper bag and pulled out 3 tuna sandwiches we'd packed for lunch. I woke Katie and handed her a sandwich, but she blinked groggily at it, then fell back asleep. By the time she woke up, the sandwich had spoiled in the sun. On the horizon, the outline of Catalina Island began to take shape. She'd be able to get food there soon enough. 3 hours later, we dropped anchor at the port of 2 harbors in Catalina, 10 miles from the main city of Avalon. Reeve and I climbed into the dinghy, while Katie stayed on the boat to nap until dinner. Racing against waning daylight, Reeve and I motored along the coast until we came to a deserted stretch of beach. After finding a well-concealed site in the hills above the shoreline, we took compass bearings and then, like pirates bearing treasure, dug a deep hole to drop the cash into. An hour and a half later, we returned to the sailboat, wet, exhausted, and elated. Bugging out was a lot more fun than bugging in. I looked forward to ending a hard day of work with a hot meal at Two Harbors' one and only restaurant, famous for its seared, slow-roasted prime rib. While Reeve napped below deck, Katie and I took the dinghy ashore. By now, her hunger had turned from craving to illness. "My stomach feels like it's being tied in knots," she complained. "I would give anything for buffalo chicken strips and hot sauce and onion rings right now." Thankfully, the restaurant was open. Though no one was sitting at the tables, there were a few patrons at the bar. "Can we see a dinner menu?" I asked the bartender. "The kitchen's closed," he replied brusquely. There weren't any customers, so the cook went home early. Katie's face fell. She asked if there was another restaurant, a pizza place that delivered, or a convenience store. As the bartender responded to each question with a curt no, her eyes began to blaze. "What if we go back to the boat?" she asked me, panic setting in. "Is there any food there?" "We buried it." "Can we go get it?" "Sure, I guess, but it'll take a while to go back and dig it up." I was so focused on preparing for future catastrophes that I'd forgotten to plan for the present. But at least Katie now understood the importance of digging holes in the ground. "I can't wait that long," Katie seethed. She scanned the bar for someone with chips or a sandwich. "I'm in such a hateful mood. I would viciously kill someone for food right now." Maybe Katie wasn't as much like the boy in the road as I'd thought. The hunger in that book was fictional. Her hunger was real. "This is exactly why I've been learning to shoot guns," I told her, hoping she'd finally realize the importance of being self-reliant. "Because one day you'll be hungry and need to murder someone for food?" "No," I replied, "so I can defend myself from people like you." "Well, if I had a gun, I would literally go on all those boats out there and tell them, 'Give me your food now.'" She glared at the bartender irritably. "I don't like being hungry." There were moments when I doubted whether all the time I'd dedicated to learning survival at the expense of movies, parties, writing, friends, and vacations was worth it. But not anymore. If even Katie could be turned violent when hungry, what would happen to a whole nation of hungry people? She looked up at the bartender, forced a smile, and pleaded, "Do you have any bread?" "I guess," he answered, "but it's cold." "You don't understand how hungry we are right now," she replied. It had only been one day without food, and already we were begging for a scrap of bread. The bartender walked away and returned with two rolls. After wolfing one down, Katie turned to me. "I'm sure you could get us all kinds of food from the kitchen." She paused to shoot the bartender another dirty look. "If all of us were stuck here, he's the first person I'd choose to eat because he's so mean." In that moment, I realized just how easily the snap I feared could be triggered. It wouldn't necessarily take 3 days without food, as Reeve had taught. It could actually take less than a day. Because it wasn't just the lack of food that was making Katie break down. It was the lack of hope. Without a peaceful solution to her hunger in sight, she'd been forced to devise an alternate plan. And when you combine hopelessness, desperation, and pain, and then dangle a remedy just outside the reach of social acceptability, the sum is often violence. Fortunately for the bartender, when we returned to our boat, we found a few crackers to sustain us. After a fitful sleep, we sailed early the next morning to Avalon and refortified ourselves with a hot breakfast. Perhaps bugging out wasn't as fun as I'd originally thought. Without a well-stocked retreat, hiding on Malibu Lake or Catalina Island wouldn't be easy. If I couldn't eventually get to a better fortified location, I'd waste away to nothing. "Maybe I should start saving up to build a retreat somewhere nearby," I told Reeve, "just in case I can't get to St. Kitts ahead of time." "That's probably a good idea," he replied. "I'd look into northern Idaho around Coeur d'Alene, or Washington around Spokane. There's cheap land, a low population density, lax gun laws, and a minimum of strategic targets." As soon as I heard the word Spokane, a memory I'd forgotten about came roaring back to me. My father once told me that in the early 1900s, my great-grandfather had sent his children, one by one, from Germany to a rural area in Washington State near Spokane. When I was a child, I'd even visited a cabin there with my grandparents. I remembered tagging along as one of my cousins picked huckleberries, caught fish on a quiet lake just outside the house, and took photos of a moose that was wading in the water. It was a survivalist paradise. I grabbed my phone and dialed my parents. "Whatever happened to that cabin in Washington Grandpa used to have?" "We're still part owners," my father said. "Is it okay if I use it as a retreat in case anything bad happens?" "I don't see why not." "Why didn't you tell me that before, when I was looking for a good place to escape to?" "We never thought about that," my mother cut in. "You're supposed to be the smart one." I pressed them for more details about the cabin. It had fishing tackle, rowboats, firewood, and a root cellar for food storage. It seemed ideal. "I'd be glad to come up there with you at some point and help you stock it," Reeve offered. "We'll cache gas along the route to make sure you can get there." In addition to my 3 bug-out locations, I now had a real retreat. However, as I flew home, I didn't feel as confident as I thought I would. Since the blackout in St. Kitts, I'd absorbed what felt like a lifetime of information. But even though I'd just successfully tested most of it, in my heart, I knew that if the shit really hit the fan, these simulations weren't enough to guarantee my survival. I was still lacking something important, besides my discouragingly delayed second passport, something that would make all the difference between life and death. And it would be the most difficult thing to find. Experience. Part 5. Rescue. If you wish to become like the gods and live for days without end, you must first possess the strength of a god. Even though you are mighty, I will show you that, like all human beings, you are weak. Gilgamesh, Tablet 11, 2100 BC. Lesson 49. What about love? "What I worry about," Leonard Cohen said as we sat in the Spartan living room of his Los Angeles apartment, "is that the spirit will die before the country dies." His words were pithy and poignant, like those of his songs, though some turned to politicians, priests, or parents when seeking answers to questions about the world. I'd always turned to music. And more than anyone, Leonard Cohen was politician, priest, and parent to me. The beauty of his words was one of the things that inspired me to write. A mutual friend, a record executive named Nick, had taken me to see him after hearing me talk about survival. He thought I'd find a kindred spirit in Cohen. As banks collapsed, the housing market crashed, the unemployment rate rose, the economy imploded, and the 2008 elections neared, it seemed like most Americans were becoming kindred spirits in anxiety. Except Nick. Soft-spoken and reclusive, Nick spent more time reading spiritual books than newspapers. Unlike Cohen and I, who fell into a class of people known as negativity avoiders, he was a positivity embracer. "But what about the protests against the Iraq War?" Nick challenged as we sat in Cohen's living room. "That was the first time anyone protested a war before it happened. Maybe that's a good sign of a consciousness awakening." "There are forces of evil in this world that are too great," Cohen responded. His wrinkles were deep set under gray hair, framing hazel eyes that shone with the vigor of a 20-year-old student and the intelligence of a 100-year-old monk. "The war," he continued, "was an inevitability." He took an unhurried sip of tea. "As for the protests," he added, "you become what you resist." Cohen stood up to put a pot of bean soup on the stove. He was 73, and his manager had recently been convicted of stealing most of his retirement fund, leaving him nearly broke and mired in lawsuits. Just miles to the south of him, Cohen said when he returned to the living room, were some of the most dangerous gangs in Los Angeles. And when their anger reached critical mass, he worried that they would spill out of their neighborhoods, and the police would be too busy trying to protect their own families to stop them from terrorizing the city. "My fear," he concluded, "is the social contract breaking down." "The snap?" I asked. "Yes, the snap." And right then, I knew he was one of us, a Flysian. I told Colin about the preparations I'd made and the survival skills I'd learned. "Look at me," he said after I finished. "I'm not made to survive. I could learn to shoot guns, but I don't have any experience in the street. I'm not a fighter." "What about love?" Nick interrupted. "You don't have to hide from violence or fight against violence. You can embody love." I envy positivity embracers for the ease with which they glide through life. They die happy, dreaming of heaven. We die miserable, worrying about hell. Cohen's answer came quickly, as if he'd already come up with it decades before, perhaps when he was playing Vietnam War protest concerts. "That's what the enemy wants, because then it's easier for them to conquer you. The people who survive persecution do so because they are strong." He then quoted a Zen aphorism, "The lotus that blooms in the water withers when it comes near to fire. Yet the lotus that blooms from the midst of flames becomes all the more beautiful and fragrant the nearer the fire rages." I had bloomed in the water, as had most Americans raised in the late 1970s, 80s, and 90s. Consequently, as Cohen put it, we were weak. That's why the events of the last few years had sent me into such a panic. Thanks to tracker school, gun sight, and Krav Maga, I was getting stronger. But if I truly wanted the ability to survive, I needed to expose myself to the heat, to harden myself, so I'd be inoculated when the flames started licking my heels. Perhaps the main reason I was even on this journey was that I didn't want to take a relatively sheltered life for granted. As a teenager, I'd been subjected to so many books, classes, movies, and comic books about sex and violence that it seemed strange neither of those two things had happened to me yet. Eventually, after a lot of work and anticipation, sex came into my life. But what about violence? Would I be ready for that eventuality? Because unlike sex, I might only get one chance to face it. When I tuned back into the conversation, Cohen was discussing a book he'd read about Auschwitz. "Some scholars," he was saying, "wonder why the Jews didn't rush forward and try to overpower the handful of machine gunners about to shoot them when they were being led to mass graves. Because they knew that even if they succeeded, they couldn't escape," I replied, attempting to contribute. "It's because that's not what they wanted to do," Cohen replied. "They wanted to reflect on their life and prepare to die." He paused and slowly picked up his teacup. "And that's what I'm doing, preparing to die." "How does one prepare for that?" I asked. Cohen never answered. He stood up to check on his bean soup, then led us to his office to play a song he'd recently written. It was a long list of horrible things that are going to happen, followed by the plea, "Tell me you still love me." It was unclear whether he was pleading with a woman or with God. I drove home from Cohen's house, feeling more anxiety than I had in a long time. I couldn't get his lotus metaphor out of my head. It pointed to a gaping hole in my survivalist training. Except for being mugged twice, I'd never been through any real disaster, trauma, or emergency. And outside of my Oklahoma City bathroom experience, I'd never had to run or fight or talk or struggle to save my life. I'd never even seen a dead body before. So if I was under stress and my life was in danger, I had no idea whether I'd be able to effectively use the skills I'd learned, or if I'd just panic, freeze, and mess my pants. I spent the next week thinking about ways to expose myself to stress and danger, considering everything from paintball, not real enough and ultimately harmless, to the military, too real and possibly fatal, to injecting myself with an EpiPen to see if I could handle the adrenaline rush. "Maybe you should try jumping in front of a train and then jumping away right before it hits you," Katie suggested when I asked for ideas. "Or what if you walk through Compton without your gun and you were wearing a t-shirt that said Bloods on it? That would be high stress." "Do you really want me to do those things?" I asked. "No, I don't, because then you're going to die." Low on ideas, I decided to turn to the experts I'd met for advice. "The best cure for stress is repeated exposure," Kelly Allwood from Urban Evasion Class suggested when I called. Unlike me, Allwood had a father who was a Green Beret and had been teaching him to toughen up since he was 6 years old. My father had mostly taught me about jazz. "So what do you do if you have no exposure outside of the regular stresses of life?" I asked him. "I'm taking EMT classes now," he replied. "It's the best emergency medical training you can get, and it's great for stress inoculation, because as part of the class, you have to ride in ambulances and respond to 911 calls." My heart raced as he spoke. There were people in Los Angeles who put themselves in the face of danger every day. Firemen, police officers, paramedics, search and rescue workers. I needed to seek them out and join their ranks. Not only would I get the experience I was looking for, not only would I get a uniform and badge that would get me past roadblocks when escaping the city, not only would I get keys to the back fire roads, not only would I be exposed to life and death situations, but I'd have the best, strongest network available, the system itself. Maybe Leonard Cohen was right. You become what you resist. Lesson 50. The odds of dying horribly. In the event of amputation of the penile shaft, whether partial or complete, an EMT should use local pressure with a sterile dressing on the stump. If during particularly active sexual intercourse, the shaft of the penis is fractured or severely angled, an EMT should immediately transport the patient to a hospital for possible surgical repair. If the foreskin of the penile shaft is caught in one or two teeth of a zipper, the EMT may attempt to unzip the pants. But if a longer segment is involved, or the patient is agitated, use heavy scissors to cut the zipper out of the pants. Be sure to explain how you're going to use scissors before you begin cutting. These valuable life-saving tips come from the book Emergency Care and Transportation of the Sick and Injured, 1,296 densely packed pages detailing nearly every medical and traumatic emergency that could possibly happen to a human being in a civilized country, from strokes to gunshot wounds to zipper mishaps. It was one of the best, most concise, most information-dense survival resources I'd read since FM 30570, the U.S. Army's Survival Field Manual. It was also my textbook at the California Institute of Emergency Medical Training, where I was studying to become an EMT. Allwood had steered me in the right direction. The course was exactly what I needed. In fact, the very first class was about handling stress. "Are you going to see people die?" Matt Goodman, the small, hyperactive head of the institute, yelled at us. The class listened in silence. "Yes, it's actually part of the job. Is this stressful?" He paused and waited for a response. A few students murmured in agreement. I was so out of my element that I had no idea whether my classmates were silent out of shock or boredom. "It's definitely stressful. The truth is, we see people die. But you don't have the luxury of screwing up just because you're under stress. You cannot let it affect you at that time. Family members may lash out at you. Don't try to win them over or change their minds. Stay calm and let it roll off your back." I felt like an imposter. The student on my right wanted to work with the fire department. The girl on my left was applying to medical school. The guy in front of me was part of a local search and rescue team. And me? I was practicing for the apocalypse. Somehow, I'd crossed a line in my pursuit of safety. I was no longer taking courses teaching me things to do just in case. I was actually going to be doing those things. In subsequent classes, Goodman drilled us on how to recognize and, when possible, treat everything that can go wrong with the human body. Heart attacks, car crash injuries, strokes, allergic reactions, seizures, poisonings, gunshot wounds, broken bones, burns, drowning, hypothermia, heat stroke, drug overdoses, childbirth complications, lung diseases, diabetic emergencies, snake venom absorption, lightning injuries, and scores of other diseases, accidents, and mental disorders. And though we were taught how to recognize and deal with symptoms related to nearly every weapon of mass destruction conceivable, We also learned that there were bigger things to be scared about than a jihad-bent teenager in a crop duster or a gun-toting neighbor with an empty stomach. Like McDonald's, for example. Every minute, an American dies from heart disease, Goodman told us, his eyes burning a hole in the chicken McNuggets I was dipping into hot mustard sauce as a mid-class snack. Though I'd spent the last 7 years worrying about the outer world, I never once thought about the inner world. I'd never considered that eating fried chicken and hamburgers and French fries was the culinary equivalent of walking through Baghdad at night. Perhaps survivalism, then, is about more than shooting guns and drinking out of toilet tanks. It's also about physical exercise and a healthy diet. After all, these are more likely to keep me alive than a solar still. Even the survivalist pioneer Mel Tappan, despite all his preparations and heavy artillery, died at age 47 of congestive heart failure. After Goodman led a class on heart disease, I decided to look into what I was up against. I wanted to know exactly what factors posed a threat to my life, and what their chances were of occurring, so I could better prepare myself for them. According to the most recent census figures, 2,448,017 United States citizens died in 2005. Of these deaths, 652,091 were due to heart disease. 559,312 were from cancer. 143,579 were from a stroke. And 130,933 were from chronic lower respiratory diseases. The fifth largest cause of death was the one Katie and I, along with every other negativity avoider on the planet, worried about most. 117,809 Americans died from what the government calls unintentional injuries. This means that every year, roughly one in every 2,500 Americans is at risk of losing his or her life due to some sort of accident or injury. According to the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, nearly 40% of those deaths, approximately 45,343, were due to motor vehicles. Being in or around them is probably the most risky behavior we engage in as human beings. Evolution never designed us to withstand impacts faster than the top speed at which we run. The next biggest cause of accidental death, surprisingly, was poisoning, which took the lives of 23,618 Americans. This was followed by falling, which claimed 19,656 lives. Despite the arguments of both those for and against gun control laws, Americans with firearms actually posed more of a danger to themselves than to other people. 12,352 people were murdered by guns, while 17,002 took their own lives with one. Overall, there were 18,124 homicides in 2005, in comparison with 32,637 suicides. Other causes of traumatic death included burns and fire, 6,496 people, suffocation, 5,900 people, and drowning, 3,582 people. Even though 8 hurricanes and tropical storms, including Katrina, and 7 earthquakes hit the United States in 2005, the number of people who died due to environmental disasters was a comparatively low 2,462. Coming in near the bottom, just above overexertion, responsible for 11 deaths, was terrorism. 56 Americans died of terrorism in 2005, not counting military personnel on active duty, and none of those attacks took place on American soil. So who was the bigger idiot? Me, who had spent the last 7 years obsessed with terrorism, economic collapse, and natural disasters, or Katie, who was too scared to drive? I teased her about her fears on an almost daily basis, but she had been right the whole time. The mundane is far more terrifying than the apocalyptic. Fortunately, thanks to my EMT training, I was now prepared to handle both. Lesson 51. Proper care and handling of Hawaiian tropic girls. My Dick Size of a Pumpkin. The ambulance stereo blasted the Mickey Avalon song through open windows. Your dick looked like Macaulay Culkin. Francisco and Rob sat in the front in uniform, shouting along to the lyrics. If you work with us, you gotta sing, they yelled back to me. It was my second day running 911 calls as a ride-along for my EMT certification. My dick bench pressed 350. Francisco and Rob were shouting out the window, now at a blonde in a black Mustang. Rob flipped on the siren to impress her. The stress exposure Alwood had promised hadn't exactly materialized. So far, we'd been to a retirement community where an elderly woman was experiencing shortness of breath